Senate Committee on Labor, Consumer, and Business Affairs, Tuesday, February 27, 1979, 8 a.m., Hearing Room A. Hearing on Senate Bill 476, Senate Bill 478, and Senate Bill 480, all relating to workers' compensation.
Meeting will come to order. First, I'd like this committee to consider we have two measures here for as committee to present as committee bills. One would appropriate $675,000 to fire standards and accreditation board from general fund for biennial expenses for certain training program improvements, and the other would create a general fund account for payments to cities, counties, and districts to improve fire service personnel training programs at the request of the Oregon State Fire. Any objections? Okay, if not, it's so ordered. Second, I'd like to announce there'll be a slideshow on workers' comp. The title is What Went Wrong at 11 a.m. in room 50. One of them was when we adopted the three-way bill back in 1965.
So, is there a slideshow stating what can we do about what went wrong?
I don't know, it's just telling what went wrong. I've seen it once. But it's a very good. If any of you have time, you should drop down there.
When is it?
At 11 o'clock in room 50. Okay, our first bill we will hear this morning is Senate Bill 476. And we'll call on Bob Kennedy, President of the FL-CIO.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Bob Kennedy, representing the Oregon AFL-CIO. We are here today to express our support for Senate Bill 476. The present law exempts sole proprietors, partners, and officers of corporations from paying workers' compensation insurance premiums. And one way to help reduce the cost of workers' compensation insurance in the state of Oregon, and an effective way of reducing costs, would be to amend the law in such a way as to require all persons, whether they be partners, ships, and or corporations, to pay all business taxes such as workers' compensation, unemployment insurance, federal unemployment, and Social Security. An employee is often a partner for the purpose of evading business taxes, but an employee, when this worker becomes injured, ORS 656054 provides that a, quote, compensable injury be to a subject worker while in the employ of a non-complying employer is compensable to the same extent as if the employer had complied with ORS 656-001-2656-794, unquote. The law further provides that, quote, all costs to the Industrial Accident Fund, including reasonable administrative costs and all attorney fees, be awarded to the claimant if subsection 1 of this section shall be a liability of the non-complying employer. The director shall recover such costs of the employer, unquote. We can see then that the law requires that an injured worker be compensated whether or not the respective employers are providing coverage. The end result is a competitive advantage for those who are forming, quote, partnerships, unquote, to avoid paying business taxes, and an increased cost burden to those who are complying with the law and providing the necessary coverage for their employees. Costs of workers' compensation insurance in the state of Oregon could be reduced and this abuse eliminated by an effective change in the Oregon statutes. To address the issue of cost and the cost savings aspect of our proposal, there is somewhat of a problem in defining exactly to what extent this abuse exists, and exactly how much in dollars and cents that this type of non-compliant employer is costing the system. The Compliance Division of the Oregon Workers' Compensation Department made 1,222 investigations of non-complying employers generally and issued 421 orders in fiscal year 1978. There were 353 claims for workers injured while employed by non-complying employers, which were sent to the State Accident Insurance Fund for processing. The Workers' Compensation Department reimburses the State Accident Insurance Fund for expenses incurred for these claims. It also attempts to recover the claim costs from the non-complying employers. Expenditures by the Department for non-complying employer claims was $1,043,500 in fiscal year 1978. The department was able to recover $171,616 from non-complying employers. Definition of who is a sole proprietor, partner, or an officer of the corporation is provided for in ORS 656027 sub 7. The Workers' Compensation Department uses two Supreme Court decisions as guides in determining who is an independent contractor and who is an employee. They are Bowser versus State Industrial Accident Commission, 1947, and Woody versus Wable, reversed by the Oregon Supreme Court, September 16, 1976. The issue of precise definition is still more closely addressed in three cases decided by the Oregon Supreme Court on December 5, 1978, in Republic Development Company, Inc. versus Oregon Employment Division, Bernie Trucking, Inc. versus Oregon Employment Division, and Mitchell Brothers Truck Line, Inc. versus Oregon Employment Division. There were at least 10 points that the court cited as tests to determine whether a worker is an employee, partner, or independent contractor. The state Supreme Court found that, one, none of the so-called, quote, independent contractors, unquote, regularly employed other workers. Two, most did not have separate telephone service for their business. Three, few had business cards and did not advertise. Four, none had a separate business establishment from the premises of the person for whom the services were performed. And five, contracts only established a pay rate, with the company being billed for each job according to the amount of work completed. None had a business he could sell for anything beyond the value of his tools. The Oregon Builders Board roughly estimates that there are about 25 to 30,000 individuals engaged in home building construction in the state of Oregon. The board, being concerned primarily with the home building industry in the state, indicates that there are 14,500 individuals or corporations registered as independent contractors. A computer check would be necessary to make the figures more specific. In order to be classified as an independent contractor, all one would have to do is register with the board by providing a $3,000 bond, $50,000 in liability insurance, and pay an annual registration fee of $30. There is no specific criteria set forth in the law that indicates who may or may not qualify as an independent contractor. As we stated earlier, the Builders Board is concerned only with those involved in home building construction and is not involved in other types of commercial contracting. Senate Bill 476 considers any person who lets a contract for the performance of labor and each individual who is considered a sole proprietor, partner, or independent contractor as a subject worker unless they file a declaration of status to the contrary. There is a large number of subcontractors and independent contractors and many types of businesses and professions, beauty and barber shops, various jobs in logging, portions of auto body rebuilding, mostly all crafts in the building trades, and trucking businesses, just to name a few. There have been problems created by some employers not knowing if they are employing employees or contractors and have wound up having to pay back workers' compensation premiums. Section 2A would eliminate this problem by simply having the individual file with the Workers' Compensation Department a declaration of status as a sole proprietor, partner, or independent contractor. Also, this will give an accounting as to how many, quote, contractors, unquote, there are operating in Oregon. This bill has been endorsed by the Oregon Labor Lobby. The Oregon AFL-CIO respectfully requests a due pass on Senate Bill 476. Also, to point out some problems that have cropped up, I did attach a letter from Mr. Eastman, and I will not read that. That's self-explanatory, some of the problems that he encountered as trying to operate. I wish I could have found the first letters that I had. He had been operating as a legitimate business. He couldn't compete, so he went and changed his mode of operation, and the letter here then explains exactly how he was operating, but I said I'm not going to
Bob, how would this work if I contract with a with a young man to mow my lawn. Say, I'll give you $10 if you mow my lawn. Contract between me and the young man, and would I have to have workers' comp? And,
well, I'm under the...
For the performance of labor, and yet... Frank, how it... On a contract for yard work or domestic work...
Domestic.
Isn't that covered under a... under a comprehensive personal liability policy? And yet I would be required to... under the terms of this, I'd be required to carry...
I think, you know, people are excluded, Senator. We're actually, what we're talking about is the portion of the statute that deals with the portion, as stated earlier, the persons that consider themselves as a partner, corporate officer, or sole proprietor. That's the portion of the statute that being... directed to.
It's not a business, but I guess I'm sole proprietor of my home. I don't know if that would do that or not.
See, we're talking about, I don't have a statute before me, but I believe it's ORS 656.
Okay, I think we're okay.
Oh, okay, fine.
Okay. Any questions? If not, thank you, Bob. Bob
thank
Hall
you.
With the electrical workers.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Hall, and I'm representing the State Association of Electrical Workers and the Oregon or the Columbia Pacific Building Trades Council. We wish to urge you today to support Senate Bill 462. As we understand Senate Bill 462, the prime purpose of the bill would be to establish a track record which would enable us to determine if there are persons taking advantage of workers' compensation system.
Senate Bill 472.
I mean 476. I'm sorry. I'm going back to last session on this one. As we understand it, there are a number of people that are taking advantage of the system. During the 1977 session, there was an attempt to require officers of corporations and sole proprietors who actually performed labor on a construction site to be covered by workers' compensation. The reason for this move was prompted by our feeling that there were a number of persons who were taking advantage of the system by forming these so-called phony partnerships, the sole reason to avoid paying workers' compensation as well as other taxes which the legitimate businessman was required to pay. Senate Bill 462 passed the 1977 session of the Senate and became lost in committee in the House. We cannot help but feel the reason this bill did not come out of committee was due to lack of accurate information. It was the feeling of a number of people that there was a problem, but no one was able to accurately state the extent of the problem. If Senate Bill 476 should pass, then it will provide accurate information as to the extent of the problem and enable the legislature to take corrective action in 1981. Thank you for the opportunity of testifying. I'll be glad to attempt to answer any questions.
Any questions? If not, thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Gary Goodman, Carpenters Union. Is this the same bill, the same draft we had in 2 years ago, 472?
Basically, it is, Senator.
Okay. 462,
Senator, committee members, my name is Gary Goodwin. I'm with the Portland District Council of Carpenters. I'm representing the also the state carpenters in this venture. We testified before this committee before, as Mr. Hall reported. The bill did pass the Senate Labor Committee and got lost. This bill was primarily
passed the Senate last year, but
Senate and got lost in the House, right? We appreciate that.
You can never defend in the House, and I've told you that before, Gary.
Beg pardon?
You can never defend in the House.
This is true. They say that they're going to pass it this year, then we've got to go with you people. My concern is, gentlemen, that with the home building industry, as we testified last session, there were many, many violations documented and are a matter of record. And I'd like to just right now review a statement made by Ben Fortner recently, the director of the Builders Board. Ben Fortner, who is the director of the Builders Board, testified recently before the House Labor Committee that there are approximately 1,400 persons registered as home builders within his division. and that he feels that approximately 25,000 persons in the state of Oregon should be registered. If all the persons registered were paying workers' compensation on themselves, the annual income received by insurance carriers for workers' compensation should be approximately $20 million. These figures are received from Dan Morley of the Workers' Safe. If all of the 25,000 workers, assuming that they were all sole proprietorship, there should be a ballooning of $48 million received by the Workers' Comp Board for that coverage. This is assuming that they were each sole proprietors with no employees. SAFE, which claims to represent two-thirds of all employees in this category, and I'm referring now to home buildings, received in the fiscal year 76-77 a mere $2,735,000 in the home building industry for workers' compensation, compared with the $2 million and the $20 million, which is a very low figure. There's a large gap of money that is not being paid into the industry for workers' compensation, although there are more people working than ever before. We're concerned that there are no longer legitimate contractors in the home building industry. They're being forced to go to the partnership situation. We had documented one case in Washington County last year where there was 39 quote-unquote independent subcontractors working on the same structure. When they were approached by the Builders Board and the workers' compensation people, the developer hand-carried the individuals to the Builders Board and had them register as sole proprietors, yet nothing was done to collect the workers' compensation insurance from these people. It should be obvious to all of us concerned that if this situation is allowed to continue, that eventually every division of construction, logging, we had a case of an airline freight carrier in Hillsboro. In 1973, he had five pilots working for him. In 1975, he had five subcontractors working for him. They contracted by the flight. They were carrying their own insurance, being in that dangerous of an occupation. We feel that if everyone working with the tools of the trade were made to pay their appropriate fair share of payroll taxes and insurance, which it'll get into later on, that this would greatly increase the input of workers' compensation premiums into the board and have them perform more efficiently, and also would reduce the premium rates in the state of Oregon, which we all know and we're all concerned with, are about the highest in the nation. And I thank you for allowing me this opportunity to testify before you.
Thank you, Gary. Any questions from members of the committee?
Thank you.
Thank you. Ed Wemple with Northwest Forest Workers Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ed Wemple. I'm with the Northwest Forest Workers Association, which is a trade association representing tree planting cooperatives, essentially mostly reforestation throughout the Northwest, in this case in Oregon. I would have written testimony, but frankly I wanted to wait until we'd heard the explanations of the bill before we submitted our testimony, for mainly this simple reason. This bill is not the same as Senate Bill 462 and 430. And the fact that it's being portrayed as such really brings up the concerns that we have with this type of legislation. In the last session, the 430-462 approach of covering self-employed people was extended to cover those who are legitimately considered self-employed under this law. Now, the fact that it's being considered that same legislation right now, I have questions about that. Why is this the case? I don't read it that way. If it's being read that way, I think perhaps it should be explained a little more depth. They are not the same law. Because this, in fact, does not change the existing law. This still allows self-employed people, sole proprietors, partners, officers of a corporation, or in the case of the members of the trade association I'm representing.
Ed, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
I understand that your group, the HODADs, are looking forward to, are looking towards obtaining workers' comp at this time. Is that true? Or?
I have looked at it over, we've looked at it since 1973.
Yeah.
In fact, this last fall, it was voted upon by our organization.
Kidding.
But that's not the point of my remarks today. The non-compliance in our industry, reforestation, is a real problem, as it is with the industries that have been mentioned here. The phony cooperatives, in the case of our trade association, is cooperatives, phony cooperatives and other means of underreporting, as well as the re-registration approach, which you had explained to you by Chuck Gill here a few weeks ago in relation to, I believe it was 279, Senate Bill 279, requiring deposits with SAIF. The questions we had about this bill, one on what exactly is the purpose. Now, I understand the purpose being explained here to gather information on exactly how many employers and how many independent contractors, partners there are in this state. And if, essentially, if everyone complied with this, you would have a long list that would cover everyone in the state. That's been explained as the purpose. And at the same time, though, it's being listed as the same legislation as 462 or 430 in the last legislation. Those two don't match. If this is to gather information, this information is already available, but it isn't being used through cross-references. You have the you have people registering with the Corporation Commission. You have people registering with the Employment Division, with the Department of Revenue, assumed business names. But none of that information is being used today. The director you just confirmed, Roy Green, stated in the task forces last summer, one, that Workers' Comp Department is not a regulatory agency. You're asking that to be done here. The first place that he recommended a cut was in the compliance division. He wanted money for audits, which is an after-the-fact investigation where somebody comes and says, this person is a phony. This person, there's been a claim here by a non-complying employer. And the available information is not being used. But that's what this bill is asking for, is to gather available information on how many independent contractors or partners there are today. So I think there's some implied reasons, and there's some reasons here which are already served or would be served by enforcement of the existing statutes or cross-referencing between your existing state agencies. The questions on the bill itself are, can you sign away your rights in this fashion? Under 656.236, prohibition against releases. No release by a worker or his beneficiary of any rights under ORS 656.001 to 656.794 is valid. I think that would have to be addressed if you're looking at signing away your rights. Or you would have to add that on, that except in this case, which seems to move away from the sole remedy situation that you have with workers' compensation. And I believe that has to be addressed. The Workers' Compensation Department, some opinions are that it wouldn't hold up. So perhaps you want to...
You say the Workers' Compensation Department said this bill wouldn't hold up?
That this particular clause of being able to sign away your releases, we've had been talking this discussion with different people in the department, it's possible that this signing away of your release would not hold up unless that particular area was addressed. Point 236. That's one of the questions, at least, that we have. Another question is how you're going to administer this. As I pointed out, this information is already available by a cross-referencing process, and it's not being done. So how are you going to administer this? You're going to demand that the Workers' Comp Department move their investigations to the front, to where everybody that goes into business has to file this? Is there a sunset clause on businesses that are already there? Or how are you going to go about getting them to file this information, and when?
We've had no complaint from any of the agencies, so I wouldn't worry about concerning yourself about that. I would, if you like the bill, if you don't like the bill for some reason, they're able to police it. We have that assurance. If there's some reason you don't like the bill, just tell us why, you know. But the bill is workable, and that isn't the problem.
Well, Senator, I appreciate that comment, but I think I'm indicating here that I don't agree with you, because, in fact, enforcement is a problem. Because the information that's available...
I would imagine any enforcement is a problem. Law enforcement is a problem. Any enforcement is a problem. That's a presumption, and I think you're absolutely right.
The particular enforcement that I'm referring to is the enforcement of this type of legislation, where you're gathering this information, because what I'm pointing out is that this information is available. And the gathering of this information is already there. It could be gathered without this type of legislation. And one of the concerns beyond this is, if you have this type of a release, how are you going to protect workers from signing away their rights just to get a job? Where you're going with an employer and handed a sheet of paper, sign this, if you want to get a job, you're listing yourself as an independent contractor. Is this going to be dealt with the Bureau of Labor? Is this the Workers' Comp Department? Who's going to have jurisdiction to prevent that type of situation from happening, which, in fact, is already occurring with the phony cooperatives that I'm describing, where a person is signing that type of a piece of paper right now? And again, that relates back to the point of the prohibition against releases in 236 and how that question is going to be dealt with. My main point here on this bill is that you have an administrative question here, one that already exists, one that's being attempted to be written further. And I would add one further point, and that is that in those task force reports, my understanding was that the director of this department believes that self-employed people as defined under 656 should be included under this law. This seems to fit with the references to this 476 being the same as 462. If it is, and if this is in fact interpreted that way legally, then we do have problems with the bill, because then you're going to be covering people that are presently exempted from the law. And the way that I read this, this doesn't change the law. This merely puts some information in writing which is already available.
I believe that covers my remarks.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, just one. Ed, is it your position that the bill is just a filing requirement and does not have a substantive change in the law?
That's correct. And that's apparently not the way it's being portrayed. I would like to know if that's the case. We just heard that it's the same as 462. We opposed 462 in the last session. So if this is the same, I would like to know it.
No, we get someone on. From the board itself?
Or from the department.
What about Cliff Allison?
Cliff Allison.
We'll have him on later. Cliff down there, too. Okay, if there are no further questions, thank you, Ed.
Thank you.
Fred Vanetta.
I am Fred Vanetta, appearing before you on behalf of the Oregon State Home Builders Association. I think if you review the statute way back, so to speak, you would find that this, in essence, reinstates the provisions of the Oregon Code that were in effect prior to the 1965 change in the law. Our people have reviewed this pretty carefully, and we think it's constructive to bring that back to the code, because it provides some certainty in an area now where it is very gray. It's been in the law. We believe it can be administered. We favor it. I might say just one additional item. I was a little concerned by some of the testimony that you heard earlier about the home building industry paying only $2 million in workers' compensation premiums in the state. I realize that when you look at a firm, why, you have a variety of classes, perhaps beyond pure carpentry, but members of my association that are in our safety group dividend program in the 77-78 premium year paid approaching $12 million in premiums. Those were just the few members, in effect, that are members of my association. So if we could figure out how to skin by about $2 million worth of premiums, we could cut the cost of housing. Anyway, back to the bill. We think it's a good bill. We commend it to you, and we urge you pass it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Fred, if you've looked at it, you know, I recognize that it's your people that this bill basically addresses itself to a large degree, and I want to know right off if you agree with Mr. Wimple that the bill is more of a filing requirement than it is a substantive change in the law.
I think that's correct. that I think it's would be our reading of the bill that it does not change the people that would cover, that are covered. It makes a system more definite and certain as to who's covered and who isn't. It increases the liability of the general contractor in cases where he is not careful and makes sure that the people that come in the door and say they're independent contractors have filed the appropriate documents. They haven't filed it, the general contractor is clearly liable.
Okay.
But if they have filed it, he isn't liable, and they're not eligible for workers' comp.
Okay, Fred, so that I understand it, let's just take the first section of Section 1. As I understand it, what that basically does is if, in fact, the individual hasn't made either of the filings, then the individual is a subject workman of the person letting the contract.
But how the
sole proprietor, partnership, or independent contractor gets around that is by merely making the filing.
That's correct.
Okay.
On the face of that, the former answer I gave you maybe wasn't quite correct, because on the face of that, why, that could change the situation.
And the second part of that, Fred, lines 12 through 15, am I incorrect, but that is just the statement of the reverse of the first section?
Each individual engaged in the performance of labor as an employee pursuant to a contract or any subcontract tender shall be considered a subject worker of the person letting the contract unless there is on file a guaranteed contract providing for the individual's worker compensation.
It's merely stating the reverse of the first section.
That's correct.
Okay. And in the third section?
If you filed with the builder's board,
okay,
and that's a self-declaration, the act of filing with the builder's board indicates that you in fact recognize that you're an independent contractor and you're prepared to run the risks of being an independent contractor. And one of those risks is you don't have unemployment compensation unless you voluntarily go out and sign up for it.
And I'm trying to get through that third one again, Fred. If you got the bill there, it says an individual who files with the department a declaration of status as a sole proprietor. That's the declaration in subsection 1. subsection 1 of Section 2. Isn't that correct? Isn't that
the
declaration
that's
talking
with
about?
The department, I think, if, when that falls into 656, the department will be the Department of Workers' Compensation.
Okay, and then it says who is required to be registered as a builder pursuant to ORS Chapter 701. So we're talking of two different filings. One is the declaration to the Workers' Comp Board, and the other is the registration of the Builder Board.
That's correct.
And that individual, if he makes both of those,
he is not eligible. He is not eligible to receive benefits.
The individual, and that one's not talking about any. Okay, I understand.
His employees certainly would be covered by the rest of the statute and would be eligible to receive benefits.
Right. I finally understood subsection 3, and that's the heart of it, of what they're after. I finally got it. Thank you.
Wouldn't that have the tendency to save the system some money?
Certainly.
Because it would essentially solve the problem of the non-complying employer.
There would still be non-complying employers who have no assets, so it doesn't solve all the problems, but I think it's a step down that road. The problem with non-complying employers, without assets, I suppose there's no good, easy, simple solution to, and this doesn't solve all the problems.
Okay, thanks very much, Fred. Jack Kalinowski, AGC.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jack Kalinowski. I represent the Associated General Contractors. I'd like to state first, Mr. Chairman, that we're in favor of the concept of Senate Bill 476. Contrary to Senator Kulongoski's remarks, a little bit contrary, if you will, I don't think necessarily the Senate Bill or that subsection 3 of Section 2 is the only heart of the bill. Subsection 2 of Section 2 is a substantial change in our estimation from the present statute. Now, the reason that I bring this up, Mr. Chairman, is because there is a name for this kind of state law that's used throughout the nation, It is called contractor under. This kind of legislation exists in a lot of other states. And in essence, what subsection 2 of section 2 says, that if a general contractor lets a subcontract for the performance of work and labor, that the subcontractor's employees are employees of the general contractor for workers' compensation purposes, unless that subcontractor provides workers' compensation and maintains that coverage for his own employees. Now, the liability then for workers' compensation coverage falls on the general contractor as we read this bill. One of the foremost authorities of workers' compensation in the nation is a gentleman by the name of Larson, who has published a and continues to publish significant decisions and interpretations of state laws. Larson, in describing the contractor under concept, states that in essence this is an admirable policy, but if the person letting the contract is required to assume the liability for his subcontractor's workers' compensation insurance coverage, then at the very least, that person letting the contractor should be insulated from lawsuits from the subcontractor's employees.
Mr. Chairman. Jack, I want you, have you got the bill there?
Yes.
Now, I want you to look very closely, and I'll tell you why I disagree with you in sub 2, and you tell me if I'm wrong. On line 12, it says, each individual engaged in the performance of labor, and the next three words are the important, as an employee. That's the whole argument about this whole process. And if you look through that whole bill, that's the only spot that refers to the individual as an employee, and that's what the argument's about. He's not my employee. Now, if that read, each individual engaged in the performance of labor pursuant to a contract or any contract they're under shall be considered a subject worker, we're talking one time about subject workers, and we're talking about the other time about an employee of a person. And I think that the inclusion of those three words, as an employee, puts us right back where we were, and that's why I think that Mr. Whipple and Mr. Bonatta have said they don't think that changes anything.
I'm not sure that I would agree with that because it, Senator, it says as an employee pursuant to a contract. I read that as an entire phrase. If a contract is let that requires the hiring of people to work as employees, I think that's the intention of this. I think that was the intention when this concept was heard during the interim by the Judiciary Committee.
Jack, and has there ever been a question that a person who is hired as an employee of a contractor or a subcontractor is not a subject workman?
Has there ever been?
I mean, that's never been the argument, has it been? If the contractor or the sub acknowledges that that's his employee, he's got coverage on the individual.
He has coverage as long as he maintains that coverage. In other words, as long as he doesn't let his policy lapse. And then becomes a non-complying employer. If he becomes a non-complying employer, a subcontractor, then the general contractor is responsible for the workers' compensation coverage for that non-complying subcontractor.
I guess this
and
is...
That's the way we're reading the bill, Senator.
Okay. I guess I'm saying this more for information of the next witnesses that testify as to the definition as an employee. Because I think that's extremely critical as to the interpretation of that section of what we're talking about.
I agree with you.
Didn't we take care of that problem in a bill during the last session? That wasn't that problem taken care of during the last session?
Not that I recall, Mr. Chairman. Not that I recall at all. There's one other point I want to make, Mr. Chairman. It seems to me that subsection 1 of section 2 of the bill is in conflict with section 20 of Senate Bill 304, which is also pending before this committee. We testified regarding Senate Bill 304 that Section 20 of the bill, which would remove entirely the mandatory coverage provision for owner-operators of trucks used in construction purposes, was important to us because some insurance carriers in this state are now requiring that a general contractor who does contract with owner-operators of dump trucks be responsible and liable for his workers' compensation coverage. One employer that I am aware of is being asked to pay $22,000 in back premiums for owner-operators of dump trucks who thought they were sole proprietors and were not required to have mandatory coverage under a Court of Appeals decision. The carriers are, at least a carrier, is assuming that that contractor then is liable for that premium. You will recall the Attorney General was asked the question, when in those instances is the person letting the contract responsible, and his answer was, it depends, and then spent about 3.5 pages more, in his opinion, describing why it depends on the individual circumstances. At any rate, this bill, should it be enacted, would mean that that person, at least in our opinion, would mean that that person letting the contract would be responsible to either pay the workers' compensation coverage for the owner-operator of a truck or another piece of equipment who thinks he is a sole proprietor, or require him to have that coverage on himself. I have one other question, Mr. Chairman, that...
Jack, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Jack, reading through again and going through it, correct me if I'm wrong, that at the present time, assuming that the employer has complied with the law and is under the system, under two, lines 12 and 13, just reading those by themselves, that situation, that's the present law. If a person is an employee pursuant to a contract, that he's a subject employee, isn't that true? And a subject worker, he's under the law now. But what that section does it not, is allow an exemption for his employer to say that you don't have to come under the workers' comp system if you provide a guaranteed contract, providing whatever it is that you're talking about in lines 10 and 11. That's an exemption. Isn't that what it is, really? Isn't that the heart of that section? Now, you want me to take you through it again?
I don't think that's necessary, Senator. I have gone over this section several times, and I've gone over it with our consultant on the telephone a couple of times, and that what I've described to you is a conclusion that we have reached now. I don't see any necessity, you know, to belabor it. I get your point.
Why don't Cliff Allison come up here?
I'll go back.
Jack,
I'm trying
to figure out what you're after in this section, because lines 12 and 13 makes a declaration that appears to me to be the law already.
Could you tell Cliff Allison to come up?
I'm not sure, Senator. I'm trying to be candid with you, and
okay, you just tell me.
And obviously, the person that I've been consulting with, who I consider to be an expert in this area, also has a problem with it.
With what that means?
Hmm?
With what that section means?
Yes. With what the thrust of that section is.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to get at.
Yes, I understand.
Sit up here, Jack, and you can. I think that anybody can answer the question. You have Cliff Allison here.
Cliff, I can't. Jack and I are confused as to what Section 2 does and does not do.
I'm concerned about Section 2.
Subsection 2?
Which indicates to me that as an employer, I could force one of my subject workmen to purchase workers' compensation law. That's the way, in other words, it is. The existing law is if you're a subject employee, you don't have to pay workers' comp. Your employer is required to pay that benefit. The way you could read Section 2 very easily is that even though you're my employee, I'm not going to retain you unless you get coverage for your on yourself.
Okay.
And that's what throws me in the situation.
So let me take you through that again. Just let me. Lines 12 and 13, just as they read right now in that bill. Am I incorrect, but that's the current law?
That's correct.
That's the current status of the law.
If you're a subject employee...
I mean, if you're an employee of a person under a contract,
right.
You're a subject worker.
Unless you're one of the exemptions.
That's right.
That's right.
But that is just the statement of the law. The change is in line 14 and 15.
That's correct.
So my concern of what I've been trying to articulate to Mr. Kalinowski is correct as to what it's going to do. I say takes him out, allows him not to be a subject worker, or in fact, in your situation, the employer says as a condition of employment, you're going to have to provide your own coverage.
This, in listening to the testimony, I personally don't feel that this bill does what it's meant to accomplish. With this bill, my understanding is that you are trying to arrive at a method of eliminating phony partnerships, that's what I've heard, or people that say they're independent contractors. You're also attempting to require more people to have workers' compensation coverage by attempting to use, quote, a prime contractor to say, you will get coverage or you will be my employees. As a matter of suggestion, you might want to look at the provisions of ORS 124 prior to House Bill 1001. There's always been a problem of trying to determine whether or not an individual is an independent contractor or an employee. There's still the problem. In the 124 provisions, they attempted to eliminate the distinction of independent contractors by stating in effect that if you were an individual who performed labor without the assistance of others, you were an employee of the prime unless you jointly had a certificate on file with the O Commission that you were an independent contractor.
Was that the way it was handled under the O Commission?
Yes, that's correct. Then went one step further. If you perform labor under a contract with a prime with the assistance of others, you were all considered to be employees of the prime unless you had a contract, a coverage yourself, or on the old system, unless you had rejected law or had coverage, but this is the concept. Now, that might be something for the committee to take a look at. The other problem that has been raised, if you look at 3 down here, is this, you're limiting this to only those who are required to be registered with the building board. What are you concerned or thinking about of other individuals who may be, quote, real estate salesmen or all kinds of other people? Are they too, if they file an independent contractor certificate, can they file an independent contractor certificate? I don't know. These are things that, and I think Mr. Young of the Compliance Division and might have some other problems with the bill, but this is just...
That would eliminate the whole thing. Wouldn't it just have to file the door?
Let me ask you a question, Cliff. If, in fact, we just had sub 1 of Section 2 and sub 3 and completely eliminated sub 2, wouldn't that do what they're trying to do?
Well, not completely. The problem you have, Senator, is that those who are subject that are not independent contractor, you need some assistance in policing the area. Now, the way to do that is to force the prime, to force these independent contractors who are employers in their own right to obtain coverage. This is one of the big aspects of this. So by eliminating, by rewriting two, though, you could accomplish two purposes. In other words, the way I understand it, if in fact you're an independent contractor, and there are some, I have a friend that's an electrician and been an electrician for 25 years, and he works a sole proprietor, and there's no reason why he should be covered. But if you, in fact, you are an independent contractor, file a certificate, that takes care of the responsibility. If you're not an independent contractor, and you're a subject employer or subject employees, This would assist, if you rewrote this, that you would force the other employers to obtain coverage, or that they would all be employees of the prime, and that would assist in policing the particular area of non-compliance.
Senator Krungoski, we have two, three other bills.
Okay, Mr. Chairman,
what I suggested, I'd like you to chair a subcommittee, and if you can get Cliff Allison, Colin Krungoski, and Bob Hall from Electrical Workers, and work with staff and...
Mr. Chairman, for whatever reason, that when I was reading the bill, Section 2 was not consistent with 1 and 3, with what they were, the policy of it, yeah. And I think it can be worked out, as Mr. Allison suggested. I think it can be a good bill.
Mr. Chairman, when you named that subcommittee, did you mean me?
I certainly did.
Oh, I see. Right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let's go to Senate Bill 478. First, I might say the reason that I sponsored 478, I was already the Workman's Comp Board during early in the session and found that there were numerous private carriers that failed to determine when whether the claim was going to be accepted or rejected. They're supposed to have 60 days to do that in. Most of them were taking number of them, especially your private insurers, were taking as many as 58, would wait till the last day before they made that determination. It's like a man being out before a jury, and it takes a jury about 50-60 days to make determination. Many of them were going over the 60 days among the private insurers. And it was costly. They were fined for doing so. So this is the bill that we've offered, and I know there's going to be some opposition for it, probably from the private carriers. But frankly, they haven't been doing the job. They've been really doing a lousy job, and there's so many companies in the state of Oregon that don't even maintain offices here. And probably one of the problems we have with the private carriers at this time. I'm going to ask Keith Wilson if he would come up and explain what's going on. That's why we've tried reducing it from 60 to 30 days. Make that decision. Keith, would you explain?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Keith Wilson, Chairman of the Workers' Compensation Board. I am not any longer involved with the compliance or the end of regulating insurance carriers, or attempting to. My perspective now is in sitting as an appellate member of the appellate body, seeing transcripts and reports of what has occurred in regard to claims management. The present law, as you've explained, Mr. Chairman, provides for acceptance or denial of a claim within 60 days after notice of the employer that a claim is being made or that an injury has occurred. I think it all comes down to human nature. If we have 90 days to perform a task, most of us will procrastinate and stall until the 59th or 89th day, and then we'll do something about it. The thrust of workers' compensation philosophy in the state of Oregon over the last four or five legislative sessions has been to hurry up the process to manage claims in a way that the injured worker knows that somebody's concerned with him, aware that he has been injured, and that there's a genuine concern shown for him on behalf of the not only the bureaucracy but the insurance carrier, to see to it that he's taken care of. Not all claims are compensable. There are many claims that are specious and do not merit acceptance and should be denied. The point that this bill attempts to make and to reach a problem area is that it expedites the process Brings about an earlier resolution, one way or another, to the issue that must be decided by the carrier. You've mentioned that we have better than 200 private insurers in this state, far too many in my humble opinion, many of them not equipped at all to manage claims. The secret of good workers' compensation program is good claims management, in my opinion. Unless the claims are handled intelligently and promptly and aggressively, it does nothing but add confusion and resentment and many, many other things that are just adverse to success. It's my personal belief, and I emphasize I'm speaking only as a member of the board and as an interested bystander really anymore, but I firmly believe that intelligent claims management can be performed by allowing not in excess of 30 days to take action on any given claim, realizing that a claim once accepted can later be denied if the facts are developed that it should have been denied in the first place, or a claim once denied can be accepted at a later time. But the vast majority of claims that are presented should be handled promptly, intelligently, and aggressively, and get on with the process of then providing whatever needs to be provided at some later point. Most of the carriers, in my observation, are doing a passable job. I think it could be improved if they were required to act earlier. I have a distinct feeling from reading 50 or 60 transcripts in the course of a month that the tendency is to, because of the volume, to assign a claim to some manager or claims individual within the insurance office, and they make their first payment of compensation within 14 days, so they buy additional time. And that file finds its way on a stack with some kind of a tickler system which alerts the person that we have 60 days time in which to do something, either accept it or deny it. If it were 90 days, they'd take that much time. I think it can be done intelligently and well, and certainly serve the system far better if the time were cut down to 30 days. With all the safeguards that are built in. Even with our present 60 days, the law presently provides for penalties for late denial of up to 25% of the time loss that accrued during that period of time, or other types of sanctions. And that adds materially to the system. I don't know that you're going to solve all the problems by reducing this time to 30 days. I think it's all comes down to good claims management and whatever can be done within the insurance industry to sharpen up the processing of claims.
If this bill were to pass, wouldn't this cut the cost in that they speeded up the process? Would cut the cost of workers' comp?
Well, I think inevitably it would. The ultimate decision on extended disability, things of that nature, certainly would could be expedited. The processing of the claim, perhaps the frustration of an individual who's waiting for 60 days for some ultimate decision on acceptance or denial, could be the concern and. Adverse effects of that delay could be, to some extent, avoided, and I think, in all, it would be beneficial to perhaps reduce the cost.
Senator Trump?
I noticed that we have a fiscal impact statement from SAFE, which indicates that it would take additional administrative money and five additional positions, FTE investigator positions, would be necessary to handle the increased workload. Would you see that as being a permanent kind of administrative cost increase, or would you see that eventually when they worked out the system of handling it in 30 days that could be reduced? But we want to cut costs, but it looks like it's going to create more work according to this fiscal impact. How would you respond to that?
Well, I couldn't argue intelligently, Senator Trowe, with safe figures on additional positions and that type of thing. I don't know. I wouldn't agree to it at this moment. I think that some refinements, a little more, not only in safe, but other in other insurance carriers, toward examining their process, could be, if initially it's going to cost, require this many more people, I would think that ultimately those positions could be, the process itself could be improved to where that wouldn't be required. That's just a top of my head reaction and impression, but
do you think that it could be done in less time than 30 days?
I think in many, many cases it could, yes. In remote...
you think in any cases it would take more than 30 days?
I can't. In a very rare case it might, but I come back to the point that they can, if they're not convinced that a claim should be accepted, they can deny it and later accept it. Or they can accept it and later deny it if they're running into the problem of time. But I am convinced in my own mind that that investigation and that decision can be made well within 30 days in practically every case and done intelligently.
If you use that solution to the problem, accept it and then later deny it, or deny it and then later accept it, wouldn't that lead to more confusion with the claimant and possible litigation, all that kind of thing?
Possibly so. But the number of denied claims is relatively minuscule compared to the overall number that are accepted. And I would have to say, in all fairness to the industry, that the vast majority of cases are accepted without any question. And it's those cases that are unnecessarily delayed by procrastination that I'm talking about. And I don't point my
finger. You said as part of your testimony that you thought there were too many carriers, too many private carriers, and that some of those too many carriers had poor claims management. Would this get at that problem, you think?
I think so.
How would it get at it?
Well, I think that they'd find themselves just unable to meet the deadline, and they'd ultimately make the conclusion that I would urge on them that they ought to get out of Oregon and do their thing someplace else. If I had my way about it, Senator Trowe, there'd be about 20 of the top performers in the private insurance industry selling workers' compensation in this state, with the state fund and with the self-insurers. Those small carriers that do operate in this state and use the services of a good service company are not subject to my criticism, because they're farming that responsibility out to somebody that knows what they're doing. But there are too many small insurance carriers trying to provide workers' compensation in this state without knowing what they're doing or not having the staff. And they're doing it as an accommodation to somebody in some other state whom they insure perhaps in some other line, or maybe in workers' compensation. And,
do you see any other way of getting at that problem of too many other than this way?
Oh, yes, through the requirements to do business in the first place. I'd put the requirements so high that they wouldn't be able to...
Yet we haven't done that. No, are there any bills that would do that?
Not to my knowledge.
Senator Trowe, I have a bill in that would accomplish that, would eliminate any company doing business in the state of Oregon that doesn't maintain adequate staff, the expertise here in Oregon. It would eliminate the more of the flaky companies, at least. There'd still be a few left.
Thank you, Robert.
Yeah, Senator Hanlon?
Chairman, I'd like to hear from somebody from SAFE about this possible
addition. Yeah, I intend to have someone up here.
Employees.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay. Senator Smith?
Keith, is there any statistical information that you're aware of which would give us some knowledge of the numbers of claims that are accepted or rejected within a 30 to 60 day period, or less than 30 days? Or
the department may have, Senator Smith. I'm not sure whether they keep those statistics or not.
All right.
Mr. Young is here.
I'll ask.
Just briefly. Keith, the change from 30 to 60, I take it, in your opinion, has a rippling effect so that we're not just talking of cutting down the process 30 days. It has to do with the hearings and everything else that I take it you're involved in at that particular time.
Yes, that's true. Okay.
Any further questions?
Thank you, sir.
If not, thank you, Keith. Now, John Pegg with EBI Insurance Company, you're opposed to it. I thought you were one of the good companies who were doing business here in the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Pequay, I'm the claim manager of EBI Insurance Company. I'm here to speak against Senate Bill 478. Most claims are accepted upon receipt by the carrier. However, when there is not enough information to allow a determination of compensability, it is usually placed in the deferred status for a maximum of 60 days. Time loss benefits are paid to the worker during the deferred period. The carrier wants to resolve the compensability question as soon as possible because time loss benefits cannot be terminated until a formal denial has been issued. Also, the carrier may be subject to penalties and attorney's fees if the denial is not issued or acceptance made within the 60-day period. The type of claim usually placed in the deferred status is not the ordinary claim. It usually involves a complex medical, legal, or factual question. From a practical standpoint, 30 days is not enough time to obtain all of the statements, the medical reports, the independent medical examinations, and related data that may be necessary to make a decision as to compensability. A claim rep really doesn't have a full 60 days to obtain the necessary information. The time limit begins when the employer has notice or knowledge of the claim. If the employer, for example, holds up the 801 to secure the signature of the injured worker on the form, let's say for 2 weeks, the claim rep is already behind that period of time, not even considering the other delay which it will need in the postal delivery system. Many claims are initiated through a hospital or through a doctor via assigned physician's initial report in 827. It constitutes notice of a claim if it's signed and the 60 days time limit begins to tick off. Even though the employee may not have reported it to his employer, he may no longer work there, or he may have left the state. Promptly obtaining medical records is a recurring problem that slows down claims of acceptance. Some medical facilities require a copy of the signed 801 before releasing medical. Some medical facilities require a specified medical authorization, and some will not accept any medical authorization whatsoever. We recently had an unwitnessed heart attack claim. The worker was taken to intensive care to the local hospital. For 2 weeks he was in intensive care and he lapsed into a coma for 3 months. Obviously, our hands were tied before we had a chance to really do anything. You couldn't get a statement, nor could you get any medical records, yet the claim was filed and the time lapse begins. If the claimant is represented by an attorney, we're often precluded from obtaining a statement because we have to work around the busy schedule of the attorney. This might be days, weeks, or on occasion, months. We know it's all difficult to schedule an appointment with a doctor and more difficult to schedule an appointment with a specialist. And I can tell you it's even more difficult if the scheduled appointment is to discuss a claim matter. In summary, I would state that we have a lot of factors precluding a prompt resolution of a claim that are not within our power to control. It would also appear that any reduction in the deferred time period would probably push more claims into a de facto denied status, which would result in more attorney's fees, litigation, and penalties. Thank you for allowing me to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Chairman.
Yeah. Senator Smith.
For my own edification, go through the process and the problems that you foresee if you're forced to make decisions early on before you have sufficient information, and how you believe that that will increase the cost finally of the whole process. If I understood you correctly, that's what you said.
If when you receive an 801 and it claims off, you've essentially got one of three decisions. You're going to make a decision to accept that claim and remit benefits. You're going to defer that claim, pay time loss benefits, pull the medical benefits in advance, pending the 60 days, or you're going to deny it. All right. Now, if compensability is not readily identifiable, you have an obligation to investigate the claim, secure the facts. Now, as I mentioned, that could be a medical problem, legal problem, or a factual question. If you deny that case immediately, you've issued probably an unreasonable denial, capricious denial. Your ability to get medical records is cut off. Your ability and accessibility to the claimant is terminated, so that if you do reach the litigation stage, you don't have anything to work with to defend that case. So you're going to lose the case, and you're also going to get hit with attorneys and penalties for probably making an unreasonable denial. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. And then tell me, do you have any statistical information regarding the number of cases that you have in the various time frame categories?
I don't have that available, but I do have my personal records available as to how EBI does. I might mention that we've talked about the anxiety of the worker, and we've indicated that time loss benefits commence. We have a program within our company where we have a personal contact program staffed by 8 benefit consultants, 2 rehab nurses, and a job developer. We contact serious disabled people within 48 hours, and our track record is very good, and they're explaining the benefits and the deferred status situation at that time. They may be told that there are some questions that are yet unresolved.
I understand you have a fine company, and there's a smiling person in the back who also thinks so. What I want to know is how many...
I'm not so sure of that.
Do you have any statistical information regarding the time frame and numbers of cases that you process through your company?
I can provide that to you.
Well, you don't have it with you?
No.
I see. I'd like to see that if you
would. I might say, Senator Smith, I have some of that information from the Workers' Comp Board. EBI is not the top company in the state of Oregon as far as getting there. They run 30 days, or more time than most companies. The best in the best, according to my information, there is Employers of Wausau.
Yeah.
I forget, you're way down the list.
Well, I would submit that
the best and safe is up there.
Yeah. That might not be necessarily a good indication of good claims handling.
No, it isn't a good indication of claims handling. I would say that.
No, I would say
right.
By making a prompt denial may be an indication of making an unreasonable denial also, just to get your stats up.
Well, I think Keith explained you can accept or reject, and you can change it, you know. But at least that man's not standing out there for 60 days and then waiting for the jury for an answer, a return from the jury. Yeah. Time after time after time, every, you know. And this is one of the problems in the system that we've learned about. And I spent some time over there, Workers' Comp Board. And let me say, EBI, I don't think is without guilt. That's probably the reason you're here today. I don't see any other insurance carrier represented here today, or there probably is their self-insured Boise Cascade. We'll have to take a look at their. I didn't look into their record over there, but it would be interesting. Senator Crow?
Yeah. The big assumption behind this legislation is that companies procrastinate and don't get this done until nearly the end of the 60 days. And if there were a shorter time span, they would get it done because they wouldn't be allowed to procrastinate. Now, are you saying that you need that 60 days?
I think under the present frame reference that we have to work in, I think that 60 days is necessary.
You need all of it? Could you get it done in 45 days?
The preponderance of the cases, you probably can. But there are those cases, like the heart attack case I mentioned, where you're in a situation where you've got...
Let me ask you, in the preponderance of the cases where you can get it done in 45 days, do you get it done in 45 days, or do you wait the 60?
We get, as soon as we can make a determination, make that determination.
Okay, well, what's your average then?
Provide that to you.
But you don't know?
I don't have it with
you. Just as you think about it, what's the average? Your estimate of the average. Do you wait the 60 days for most of them, or do you get them done in 45 days or 30 days when you can?
I would say there's probably a split. Probably get half of them done within the 30 days and the other half in the remaining 60.
Senator Crow, I'd like you to, we get some of these files from over at SAFE, or in not SAFE, but Workman's Compensation Board, I think it'd be interesting to take a look at them for the benefit of the committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I'm still unclear of exactly who would be damaged if, in fact, we push this back to 30 days. You have to make a payment within 14 days of the claim.
Correct.
Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
But you can put the claim into a deferral status for 60 days.
That's correct.
And in that 60-day period, the claim that's getting paid is time loss. And if, in fact, you deny the claim after 60 days and it's upheld, you just are out the money that you paid to the individual.
That's correct.
During the appeal period, after your 60 days and you deny it, and the claimant files the appeal, he doesn't get paid time loss for that. He doesn't get time loss in that appeal period.
That's right.
But if he prevails, he gets to go back to the time you cut him off, and then
all benefits due and all
okay.
Payable.
So the claimant, it appears to me, on the 30, 60 days, is it? I mean, if it's 60 days or 30 days, he's in the same position as far as dollars of him getting time loss. He's in no different. So it appears to me that the people that are affected by this are the insurance companies. Isn't that correct?
For that, and I would say the medical bills may be held in abeyance.
Okay. And as I understand it, your concern is that if you are forced into a 30-day period, you think that you will be forced to make more denials. And, Mr. Chairman, I should claim my conflict of interest at this particular point because of the fact it will necessitate hearings which will result in attorney fees which are not based upon the 25% but upon the reasonable nature of it, which anywhere from $500 to $1,000. So you think you're going to incur more attorney fees
I think that
paying out and more claims going to hearing?
I think that's true.
And so now let me ask you this, the other side of that, would you want 90 days?
I think that our particular operation, we've been able to work within the 60 days satisfactorily.
And so your position would be just contrary to Mr. Wilson's, the director, chairman of the board, and in fact that you think this would result in greater cost, not administrative cost, but cost to you.
That's true.
Okay, that's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, thank you. Virginia Johnson with Boise Cascade.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm here today representing Boise Cascade Corporation, a direct responsibility employer. I have been the claims consultant responsible for the proper and timely management of workers' compensation claims in Oregon for the last 3 years. Prior to this position, I was a claim examiner for SAFE, so I'm also familiar with that operation. I wish to offer testimony this morning both personally and as a representative of Boise Cascade in opposition to Senate Bill 478. The proposed 30-day time period would, in effect, negate the deferral status and any benefit to be gained by same for the following reasons. The purpose of the 60-day deferral period is to allow the insurer adequate time to gather complete information on which to base a sound and logical decision concerning the compensability of a claim. As earlier testimony has indicated, most claims are accepted. Very difficult to gather adequate grounds for a denial. This occurs very rarely, and they must be properly and completely prepared. At the same time, the deferral period is an information gathering period which we can very easily explain to the claimant and thereby avoid an adversary relationship. When a decision is reached, the complete reasoning can be offered to the claimant. There is no benefit to be gained by the claimant in a 30-day decision limit, since he will receive benefits until a denial decision was made, whether it's a 30 or a 60-day time frame. Excuse me. There is a loss of benefit to the insurer if a hasty decision is made, which later must be changed when all the facts are gathered. This can create an unnecessary adversary situation, as not only the insurer, but as the employer, I think you can understand that in employee relations, to tell someone, yes, your claim is accepted, you're receiving your benefits, and to turn around and say, ah, now we are taking it away, we are denying a claim, is far more difficult than to have made a sound decision in the first place and creates personnel problems and hard feelings.
Mr. Chairman, are you saying that you would, within the current law, that if you accepted a claim and then found out later it should have been denied, you were going to file a denial with it?
And you turn around and deny the claim, right?
After the 60-day period?
Right. You get. I'm saying within this, if you reduced it to a 30-day period, say there is medical information that has not been received yet. There may be still a question, but if there is not sound information, we're going to accept the claim, and you accept the claim and turn around and then deny the claim.
When? In excess of the 30 days?
In excess of the 30 days, right, when all the information is in. To explain a change in your decision to a denial is far more difficult than to have all the facts to begin with and explain, we are denying your claim, these are the reasons. I think it's human nature, you know, if you've been told this is accepted or you have this, and then you turn around and take it away from the person, that's a far more difficult situation than to have made the decision properly in the first place.
And, you know, you bring up an interesting point I was thinking about with the other witness here, and when I was asking the question about, he was arguing from the position, I'm going to have to make these denials. Let me ask you, aren't you as concerned or not more concerned about being required to accept cases within the 30-day period more than you are the denial? Because
either way, it's I'm saying it's inadequate time to make a proper decision. Okay? Any other questions in that regard?
Senator Troll?
The previous person from EBI indicated that most of the majority of the claims could be processed, handled in 45 days. Is that true in your case? I think he said that.
I would tend to agree that that's probably true. However, as it's also been indicated, most claims are accepted. We're talking about a small number of claims where the compensability is seriously questioned. And if it's seriously questioned, then there's usually a lot of factors that you're looking at, and particularly the accessibility of medical appointments and obtaining reports of those consultations and obtaining perhaps pertinent past medical history of the person. You know, we have no control over that. It just cannot be done like that.
Let me ask you. You say most of the claims will not be contested, therefore there's not a problem with most of them.
Right.
Did those get processed quickly, or do you automatically just put them all back on a 60-day kind of operation?
No.
What's your average length of time?
I could not, off the top of my head, give you the statistics.
You can't give the statistics either.
No.
Even on those that you're sure are not going to be contested, but just going
to
go
I would say that the number of claims to begin with that we defer are probably, and this is going to be strictly off the top of my head, less than 10% of the claims that even ever go into a deferral status that are really questioned.
Okay. Those that are not deferred then are processed
are
immediately?
Are accepted and processed, right.
How long does it take those to get through?
A decision to accept the claim is with those that are accepted is normally made at the within the 14 days before the first payment of compensation.
And they know it, and they know it's complete.
Right. Mm-hmm. Any other questions in that regard?
Senator Hanlon?
Are there any instances in which where Boise Cascade, as a self-insurer, would have something to gain by deliberately delaying?
Deliberately delaying?
To the 59th day. Any reason why you would deliberately want a delay? If you could close the claim at day 29, is there any reason why you would want to delay it to day 59?
No, I can't think of any reason. If it's an acceptable situation, obviously, we want to let them know it's accepted. If we're going to deny it, you know, they're getting benefits, so why would we want to delay the denial?
I'll say this. I think the self-insured are doing a better job, and they're on top of it because it's money out of their pocket, and it's direct. And I think sometimes when you have the private carriers that go between there, that they tend to say, well, the insurance company's going to pay. And the insurance company has a plane, and I think that probably one of our great problems is in that field is, as Keith has said and others have said, is just poor staff.
Mr. Chairman, wouldn't the very same thing be true of any insurer? Nothing has been said here this morning that suggests to me that anybody has anything to gain by purposely delaying.
I think it's pure laziness, probably.
Yeah.
I don't think they have anything to gain, but it's still the records there that they are waiting till the 58th, 59th day, and many going over and being fined as in exceeding the 60 days.
Mr. Chairman,
could
I ask you,
yes.
You've looked at those records. Do you find that happening in cases that are not really very controversial, just on the average?
I couldn't tell you, but they're just going seemingly taking too long. They wait. There's companies that just wait till the last day before they do anything about it. Mm-hmm. It's just pure procrastination. And what we'd like to do is, one of the things I think is necessary in the workers' comp is to speed up the process and make these decisions. And
doesn't that procrastination cost them something?
I would presume that it could, yes.
Well, I would think that would be
the cost the employer.
I think that would be the greatest impetus towards an early closing of the claim.
May I continue with my comments?
Thank you very much. Unless you have anything further?
I would like to conclude my testimony,
oh,
benefit,
I'm fine.
If I may, please.
Go ahead.
I also wanted to make the point that there is a strong possibility that in an attempt to avoid unfair and unsound decisions which have long-lasting implications, the insurer will stretch the 30-day limit and subject themselves to penalties. I certainly feel I would be tempted to do this in a case if I did not have the information there, but I thought maybe I would have it within another week. Rather than tell the person a decision that I was not sure of, I would rather run the risk of going beyond the limit and taking the penalty. And this would be partly just as good employee relations also. A 30-day period is often inadequate to conduct a thorough investigation, particularly if outside professional services have to be used by the time you contact a person, engage them, get them on the job, get the report back, and so on. A 30-day period is, in my opinion, definitely inadequate to obtain medical evaluations, which are usually necessary in cases where compensability is questioned. It has been my experience that it takes an average of 3 to 4 weeks to obtain an appointment and another 2 to 3 weeks to obtain the medical report. We are usually right up to the 60-day deadline before we have the information for our decision-making, and hence a 30-day time frame would be unrealistic.
Where's your problem as far as the slowness? What's slowing you down? Is it the doctor's reports?
The medical problem is definitely a main one. I don't know how many of you have tried to get an appointment lately, particularly with a specialist.
What about the reports, getting the reports from the doctor?
It's going to take 2 to 3 weeks often to get that report, right? By the time they dictate it and the gal gets it out of the typing pool and in the mail to you, it's usually at least 2 weeks after the appointment.
Well, that's 14 days.
And also the 30-day period is inadequate to obtain and confirm past pertinent medical history. Maybe the person has just moved into the state, you have information that they have had similar injury or problems, and you start trying to find out from the other state, contact those doctors, what medical releases they're going to accept, and so on. It's very rare that you can gather that information within 30 days. In summary, the 30-day limitation would nearly eliminate a deferral status and a benefit to everyone. There is little more that can be accomplished between the 14-day limit on payment of compensation and the proposed 30-day limit on decision of compensability. The complexities of the compensability of a claim, which is questioned, cannot be resolved within 2 weeks nor 4 weeks. Less often, they cannot be resolved within 8 weeks. Since this change would benefit no one, would not allow sufficient time for intelligent decision-making based on facts, and would very likely increase litigation, we are opposed. Any further questions? Thank you.
That's the last witness. I think what I'm going to do on this bill.
Ed Whipple, did you want to testify on this? Did you get your answer?
Yeah, I got my questions. Yeah.
Okay.
Did you get yours, Chuck?
I think I'll appoint a subcommittee consisting of Roy Green and Keith Wilson and myself in this bill.
Keith?
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
We had one witness testify in favor of this bill and used the term procrastination. I'm wondering if Comp Board perhaps inadvertently is admitting that their part of the process is not proceeding as rapidly as it should. I'd like to know just whether there's some fire behind that smoke.
Well, they have the files, and they get the files, and it's there, and within 58 to 60 days, what they're reporting is that they feel that the insurance carriers could speed up the process in getting those, in making that decision, rather.
Well, I guess I'm wondering if the comp board is making their decisions as rapidly as they should.
Well, you might take a look at it. I mean, this is, their files are open. I'd take a run over there. We'll bring them before the committee. So let's go to Senate Bill 480. Herb Simpson from Abbott.
My name is Herb Simpson. I'm the sole owner of Abbott and Simpson Roofing and Gutters. I live at 3415 Northeast 19th in Portland, Oregon, 97212. I'm currently a member of the National Roofing Contractors Association, the Western States Contractors Association, Roofers Contractors Association, and I am the immediate past president of the Associated Roofing Contractors in Portland. This association represents roofing contractors in Oregon and Southwest Washington. At present, I represent this association on the Construction Industry Policy Council, which meets to discuss problems common to the construction industry in Portland and Southwest Washington. And before I go into reading the balance of my remarks, I'd like to just take the privilege, if you don't mind, Senator, of discussing the two bills just briefly that were before us, because frankly I didn't know that they were going to be taken up today, but I do have a position on them.
Mr. Simpson, let me do it this way with you, would you? Because we have a schedule on the time, let me do this. Let me take you through this bill first, and if the committee members are still here, why don't we hold it open for the comments on the other two bills at the end?
No problem.
Do it that way, please.
While I do not speak for any of these association members, associations today, I do consult with many members on issues confronting employers in our industry. I don't know if it is generally realized or not, but if you are a member of an association that has signed a contract with a union, that contract is legal and binding on association members for the life of the contract. What concerns those of us who have contracted to pay high construction wages is that there is a danger that we will find ourselves priced out of the market. This is not only because of high wage costs, but because of high labor-related overhead costs as well. At the present time, one of the main reasons union contractors remain competitive is that construction consumers must contract through union contractors because the vast majority of the construction labor pool comes from the various craft unions. Those of us in the construction industry who are bound by union contracts, however, would be less than responsible if we failed to notice the creeping growth of the merit shop movement all across our country. This movement's growth is determined by the growth in the skilled labor pool outside the unions. If this movement reaches the size that a serious confrontation between the merit shop movement and the union movement develops, this will bring about such chaos in the industry that it will have a very detrimental effect upon the whole economy. SB 480, which we are discussing today, goes to the very heart of one of the major cost problems Construction Industry Association members face today. In all but an insignificant number of cases, union workmen receive higher wages than those who are not organized. This means that union contractors pay a higher premium for workmen's compensation for the exact same risks as do non-union contractors. Under the present percentage of wages method of assessing costs, every time a workman gets an increase in wages, the cost of workman's compensation goes up automatically, without regard to any change in the risk factor. This is shown quite graphically when you consider that prior to the current contract with the union, roofers' wages were $11.05 an hour. At the present time, their wages are $12.15 an hour, a rise of $1.10, or 10%. Automatically, my workman's compensation premium went up another 35 cents to $3.89 an hour per man. This 35 cents over what we paid just 1 year ago is 37% of the total hourly cost to roofing contractors in our neighboring state of Washington. They pay 94 cents an hour per man. When you consider what Washington roofing contractors pay under their two-way setup, you have to be concerned. You have to be concerned and question the wisdom of the controversial three-way law that we operate under here in Oregon. I am sure that when you take under consideration the two-way bill in the days to come, you will hear argument from the insurance industry that somehow you are dealing a blow to free enterprise in our state. I submit to you that every time I pay my monthly workman's compensation premium, the present setup deals my free enterprise a blow that is near fatal. Ironically, Washington contractors who take out the necessary bonding and municipal licenses in Oregon can outbid us on jobs put out by any of the various political jurisdictions in our state. When the bidding is sharp and by law the low bidder gets the job, this $2.83 an hour makes the difference of who gets the job. On a modest five-man crew, for example, this difference comes to $118 a day or $500 in a week. Nowadays, you can take your wife to Hawaii on that much. Oregon contractors can become bonded and licensed in Washington, too. I have been one for many years. This brings up an interesting and tempting point. As I understand this reciprocal agreement covering workmen's compensation between the state of Oregon and the state of Washington, my workmen, who of course I have hired in Oregon, pay the Oregon rates when working on jobs in Washington and vice versa. However, if I hire a man who starts to work for me while I am doing work in Washington, it doesn't matter where the man lives. From then on, that man's workman compensation must be covered by the state of Washington, even though almost all his work for me will be performed in Oregon. I don't even have to have a phone over there. I can assure you, I am sorely tempted to send my whole crew back to the hall and hire them back again the next time I do a job in Washington. I've heard that the workman's compensation law in some of the other states will show that these states, especially those with the lowest rate, drop the worker off the compensation rolls as fast as they can, and of course the worker frequently then ends up on public welfare. There is another industry inequity in determining premium costs that I would like to bring out at this time. Disability is not paid on the basis of the premium paid. It is paid on 67% of the average wage in the state. I don't know if this is a regulation or part of the law. This comes to something like $5.15 an hour at the present time. This means that those of us who pay the high construction wages are paying for those businessmen who pay low wages. If you have a fair-sized family, you can qualify for food stamps at that rate. It is hard for me to believe that many high-paid construction workers have it made when they get an Oregon back at that wage. In conclusion, I'd like to say that I was led to believe that there would be a committee set up after the end of the last legislature to consider the various problems of workmen's compensation costs. This committee or commission would hopefully have had recommendations ready to be made to the current legislature. As far as I know, this was never done. At least I've never read anything about it in the newspapers. Among other things I would have urged the committee to investigate would be a comparison between the rates paid in the state of Washington and our state over a long period of time. For example, from the time the Oregon passed the three-way bill up to the present time. This will allow us to compare a so-called stable period of prices with the present inflationary period. It would also show how close the two states were when the law was originally passed. I would also have urged them to investigate and compare the different lengths of time other states keep injured workmen on disability and trace what happens to them when they are removed from the rolls. Have they been rehabilitated, and if so, where and at what wage? How many are on public welfare? Find out if what has happened to in other states is what we want for our skilled workmen who do all the hard and dangerous work for us to look forward to if they get injured on the job. I had a man working for me a couple years ago who had gone over to another contractor during the drought. This man fell and was permanently injured. Recently, he was given a settlement and removed from the rolls. I've talked with him and also his social worker who is trying to get him into some other type of work. The lady who was helping him advised me that she had finally convinced this 55-year-old man who had been a skilled roofer all of his adult life that he will be lucky to get a job that pays $4 an hour. Just a few weeks ago, some sort of blue ribbon committee was set up to look into various workman into revising the workman's compensation law. I hope they can get their act together before the legislature ends. It is too bad that a year has been lost in the meantime. This type of legislation is too important to the economy of our state to be satisfied with this quick decisions. Certainly one of the most needed change is to bring equal payment for equal risk into the law by passing Senate Bill the SB 480 during this legislature.
Simpson, I want to compliment you on your presentation, both for the analysis of the workers' comp law and also your political commentary on labor movement. In fact, I'm going to ask the committee clerk, Bob, I think you should get a copy of this and read this because I think it's extremely pertinent, and I think that Mr. Simpson has a legitimate point, and I'm more interested in the fact if you have ever served on any committee on workers' compensation before.
No, I never have, but I want to just let you know where I'm coming from. I want stability in the construction industry. Now, if you recall, one of the things that John L. Lewis, when he was organizing the coal mines years and years ago, went to the employers and put this point to them. The way it is now, this guy pays that wage, you pay this. And as soon as this guy gets a little bit more work, he hires your man and vice versa, and it takes him away from you with a few cents an hour, and then you get work, and you get this guy back. And we don't get a stability. I want to know what my labor costs are. And I know it under the setup I have. Now, I'm concerned about this merit shop business. See? That merit shop, I am bound by union. Now, as I mentioned in my report, this is a very important thing for contractors to realize, that if you get out there outside the union, who are you going to hire? See, as long as the skilled workers are in the labor movement, those of us who are contractors doing construction work had better stay with the union and cut our costs in some other direction. But anyway, this is the way I'm at. I think that this business of chaos that can soon envelop us is a very serious thing.
I think it may be closer than a lot of people want to believe.
Well, that's what concerns me.
Any other questions? Mr. Simpson, if you'd wait until I get these other three witnesses on this bill, I want you to come back up again on the other two.
By the way, my remarks on that will be very brief if you'd like to get it over with now.
Since you're there, you go right ahead.
Well, I want to, first of all, I'll talk about this SB 478, the 60 to 30 days. My men, if any of them were hurt, the first concern their first concern is to be provided by, their families be provided for. Now, I think that one of the questions of the 60 days, this business of some mysterious reason, all of these claims are being paid on the 59th day. Well, there's a pattern there that we can obviously analyze, and the pattern is this, is that who's ever holding that money up, and I assume it's insurance companies, are holding it up to add to the interest of that money in their bank account. Now, let's just face it, and that is the only reason that could be for. Now, I think that that in my judgment, this bill was mainly directed at out-of-state big companies who come in and have no regard to the feeling for the workers in the state of Oregon, and their main deal is how can we make a few pennies more on our profit. That's as simple as that to me. Now, 476, one of the things that we find out there is that, especially in the construction industry, some guy will be out. In roofing, we call them hatchet men. All they need is a ladder and a hatchet, and away they go on the back end of their car. But the risk involved for those workmen out there are the same as the man that I sent out there, and I can't imagine that the state of Oregon would ever do anything but to insist that everybody who gets up on a roof, for example, but any of these trades should insist that they be insured if he wants to or not. Now, you brought, or somebody brought up the HODADs. This is, and then I'll be through. Now, with the HODADs, they had quite a representation here the last time I spoke on this particular bill. And, you know, this group are sort of like motherhood and apple pie to me. How can you be against the HODADs? You see, I mean, and I understand this.
That's what I tell Senator Groner all the time.
Oh. Yeah. But let's just put it another way. Most of their work is from the Bureau of Land Management. Now, I can't imagine that anybody who is concerned, as these people evidently are, for their people, wouldn't grind in the cost of good coverage for them. And I'll tell the whole dads this, that sooner or later, somebody's going to get seriously hurt out there in those forests. And regardless of that feeling for the HODADs that they may have, if they get killed, their estate is going to go after the HODADs regardless of a cooperative anything. Now, just one... Well, in that regard, I can't see why they would be against workmen's paying workmen's compensation and just put it into the Bureau of Land Management cost. They're dealing with another arm of the government. Now, just one final thing on that. I pay 4% of my premium to a fund that's set aside for people who are injured and not covered. Is that right, Senator? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm paying on anybody who isn't paying their share of this freight. See, they're already covered. And I think that what we're trying to do is to get them up front with the coverage. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Simpson.
Any questions?
If not, thank you.
Bob Kennedy, FLCIO.
This guy is sure.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I want to start off by saying that this bill did not come out exactly the way we wanted it to be, and what I mean by that is our intent was that it would cover all carriers, not just SAFE, and this, as the way the bill is printed, it is just in the form to affect SAFE. Now, late last evening, committee administrator was presented with some proposed amendments, which we would hope that could be worth then to take care of the problem so that it would cover all carriers, not just SAFE.
I think staff working with you on those amendments,
yes,
they will. Okay, fine.
So with those amendments, then the Oregon AFL-CIO would support Senate Bill 480. And Senate Bill 480 addresses the issues of workers' compensation insurance premiums and would remedy a very unfair situation which exists in the current law. And to make the system fair for all employers that hire persons doing the same classifications of work, they would pay equal premiums because the risk, hazard, or exposure is the same as are the benefits for persons earning $5.62 an hour or higher. This $5.62 was arrived at using 173 hours per month divided into the average weekly wage, which is $224.16 at this time. Workers' compensation insurance premiums are now calculated as a certain percentage of the total amount of payroll. Our proposal is based on the simple premise that if everyone benefits equally from the system, everyone should bear equally the burden of cost. For example, let's say that two employers hire carpenters. One employer pays $10 per hour, the other pays $8 per hour. Workers' compensation premiums based on $100 of payroll penalize the employer that pays the higher wages. In this example, the premium for the employer paying the higher wages would be 20%. Should both employees suffer the same injury, however, their benefits would be paid at equal levels. On the present state average weekly wage, anyone that earns $5.62 per hour or more will get the same maximum benefit. This bill is also endorsed by the labor lobby, and we respect the request to do pass on Senate Bill 4080 with amendments to include all carriers, not just SAFE. Thank you.
Senator Hanlon?
Bob, what about the problem of auditing this?
As it stands now, an employer reports wages, both state and federal, and there are several reasons why he must do that accurately. But would he be under the same sort of compulsion to record and report hours or days worked? How would you audit this? How would you avoid the problem of somebody misreporting or failing to report the number of hours worked?
Well, Senator, giving you an illustration of my personal experience when I served as business representative, I even run into situations where people were working 10 hours a day and then they'd write in 8 hours on their time card. And so I think that if somebody makes up their mind they're going to chisel, they're going to find some way to get around it, regardless of whether they're charging at the present time on $100 a payroll or whether they charge cents per hour. I really don't have an answer as to how they do that. Now, the state of Washington does use this system, and I wish that I had the answer as to how they, or what type of problems they do have with regarding the questions you ask.
Do you happen to know how many other states use the hourly rate?
No, I do not. Steve, do you have any idea? Oh, there's only one. The indication has to be
safe. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Bob Hall, the electrical workers. Just a minute, Bob. I've got to go to another meeting. Would you ask Sadie to also explain why I put through their name down?
Go ahead, Bob. Okay, thank you. My name is Robert Hall, and I'm representing today the State Association of Electrical Workers and the Columbia Pacific Building Trades Council. It is our contention that Senate Bill 480 would provide a much fairer way in which to assess workmen's compensation rates. We feel the premise that equal exposure to hazards should bring equal rates. The system that works in Oregon today penalizes the employer who is paying employees a fair wage, it tends to subsidize the employer who is paying less. I would like to cite a couple of examples. A boilermaker in Lane County earns $12.75 per hour based on a 173-hour month. His wages would be $2,205.75 for compensation premium of $169.18 a month, whereas a boilermaker in Multnomah County would make $12.94 an hour for a monthly rate of $2,338.62. His compensation premium for that employer would be $171.70 for a difference of $2.52 a month. Now, these rates that I've cited here come from the Oregon Bureau of Labor on the established wage rates. A far more graphic example would be in a trade in which I'm more familiar. According to the Department of Labor, an electrician in Jackson County earns $15.03 per hour. The premium on that on 173-hour month would be $143.45, whereas an electrician in Multnomah County earns $15.25 per hour for a premium of $147.48, not too much difference. But there are many electricians in the state earning $12 per hour or less. The premium on an electrician working for $12 an hour would be $116.05 per month for a whopping difference of $31.43 per month. The electrician working for $15.25 and the electrician working for $12 per hour are exposed to exactly the same hazards. I might add here that I did a little bit of quick calculating and came up with a figure of approximately $8.40 per hour based on a 173-hour month would earn the maximum benefit. So these two electricians paying the premium of $31 a month difference are receiving the same benefits, being exposed to exactly the same hazards, and I don't think it's really fair. To us, it hardly seems fair that an employer who pays his workers a higher wage should be penalized by paying a higher compensation rate for workers doing exactly the same job and being exposed to the same hazards and receiving the same benefits. The state of Washington uses this system now, and I feel that the people of Oregon would benefit from the adoption of Senate Bill 480. Thank you for the opportunity of letting our views be known. I'll be glad to attempt to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
Mr. Goodwin?
Senator Gulongoski, Senators. My name is Gary Goodwin, District Councilor Carpenters of Portland and vicinity. I think this is going to be getting to sound like an echo chamber up here, but I would like to echo the sentiments reported by the previous two gentlemen, and particularly being a representative of the labor movement, applaud the comments of Mr. Simpson. He told it like it was, as far as I'm concerned. My comments are going to be basically the same as were reported earlier. I'm relating primarily to the carpentry field in residential housing. We have a rate of $10 an hour for residential carpenter in the Portland area, so I'll use that as a base. We have contractor A paying his employees $10 an hour. His workman's comp premium is $64.44 per week, or $1.61 an hour. Contractor B, again doing exactly the same kind of work, paying his employees $5 per hour. Workman's comp premium per work week, $32.22 an hour, or $32.22 per week, at a rate of $0.80 per hour. Our contention is, Mr. Chairman, as Mr. Hall just reported, that the accident risk to employee A and employee B is identical in all situations. They fall off the roof, cut a finger or whatever, they go to the same hospital, receive the same treatment, yet contractor A, who may pay his employees more money either through a labor agreement or for rewarding them for being a qualified work person on his workforce, is being penalized at every turn. We submit that, as in the insurance business and automobiles insurance, when you and I go out to buy automobile insurance, we start out from square one, same rate. The risk involved, as me being a worse driver than you might be, then my premium would go up. This method could be and should be established by the Workers' Compensation Board. We feel that an equitable premium based on the type of work involved on a cents per hour basis, where everybody is paying a premium for exactly the same type of coverage, is the only equitable way to get rid of the antiquated method of collecting right now. Now, we'll concede that taking a gross percentage of payroll, applying a formula of a percentage rate, as in residential, of 16.11%, is a far simple way to compute workers' compensation insurance. I think that on a little effort, that a solution that could be an answer to the question that was asked by the senator just recently, a method could be found of auditing this system. As was reported, there's going to be cheaters in every field, and there are today. We all realize this. But the sooner that the people that are out there trying to fleece the system and have our legitimate contractors pay the premium on those who are not paying into the system, as soon as we can correct that system situation, the better off I feel that we're going to be. Thank you, Senators, for allowing me to come before you.
Thank you.
If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Are there any questions? Thank you, Gary. Mr. Fritz?
Yours. Mr. Chairman, I'm Bill Fritz, Insurance Commissioner for the State of Oregon. I brought Mr. McGavitt with me to assist and perhaps make some recommendations or suggestions to the committee. First off, I want to advise the committee that the insurance department has no position on this particular bill one way or another. We have whatever system the legislature and the executive branch determine is feasible or desirable for the state, we will see to that is put into operation. I have heard a lot of testimony here today comparing the system in the state of Oregon with the state of Washington, and I just want to caution you on the fact that, in effect, we're comparing apples with oranges. You really cannot compare the two systems. The benefit structures are different, and there are a lot of differences between the two systems. However, that should not influence your particular judgment on the desirability of what's suggested in this bill. I have serious reservations, and Mr. McGavitt will elaborate a little further on it, about the feasibility. The current bill as it stands, I think, would be unworkable in the state of Oregon. What we would be doing would be dividing the systems. You would have SAFE operating under the system of hourly rate.
Bill, why don't you just assume, why don't you assume that everybody's the same?
They will just assume that the bill is amended and that eliminates that particular objection. There is some question by the National Council as to whether or not they could possibly gear up and gather statistical data to which to promulgate rates on that particular method. There's only one state that I know that uses the hourly rate, and that's the state of Washington. With reference to Senator Hammond's question on the effect of audit, we did some research with the Washington Department on this particular point, and it's rather astounding or shocking to me to find that their figures estimate that there is a loss of revenue to the department up there in excess of 12% of the total amount of premiums generated. I do not know about the validity of that information, but anyway, that's what they have told us. I'm going to ask Mr. McGavitt to go into a little more technical detail on the problems that are confronting us on the adoption of this particular system.
Mr. Vice Chairman, Senators, Dick McGavitt, Deputy Insurance Commissioner, we would wholeheartedly support the amendment to this bill. It would cure the otherwise defect of destroying the statewide, the integrity of the statewide rating base of the state. I have a list of other concerns, however, that are still with us, notwithstanding the amendment, and that would be the result in the inequitable redistribution of the premium among the 40,000 smaller employers of our state, and I'll elaborate on these points later. It would require approximately a five-year transition program at an ordinance cost, which would be borne and reflected in the rates, be it under a man-hour basis or a payroll basis. It would impose the indirect cost of a dual bookkeeping system to account for 800,000 man-years, and it would be an auditor's nightmare. It would, well, with the amendment, it would only partially eclipse the effect of our experience rating and premium discount functions. And it would distort the actual exposure hazard. Further, it would require a massive re-education that's taken us a decade to achieve an understanding under the three-way system that stands today.
Mr. McGavitt, could you go over your points and clarify
this point right now, Senator? Glossing over the integrity of the statewide rating basis, it would have been cut 50%, but the amendment cures that. What I'm referring to is that you would have dual systems, and the credibility factors are such that you would have to have a cross-tempering of the man hours to the payroll basis, just as we currently in low credibility classifications of the 750 existing classes, which about 450 of them are used in this state, in the low credibility areas where there's low experience, payroll, and loss data for serious, non-serious, and medical-only claims.
We refer to
national experience, which is weighted for Oregon law. But your amendment cures that difficulty. The hourly basis of exposure reallocation affects the reapportioning a greater burden of the $500 million upon approximately our 40,000 smaller employers.
Senator Smith.
Say that again. I didn't hear you.
Okay.
Did you say?
We have approximately 60,000 employers in the state, Senator, and utilizing experience rating information, wherein those employers with a premium of $1,500 or greater experience rated, and believing that parallels with the notion that larger employers have negotiated wage scales and the smaller employers do not. We view then, since there's 20,000 rated risk, they have experience rated, we have about 40,000 smaller employers. I believe that would parallel with the statistics on when you were to define small employers, those that would have more apt to have non-negotiated wage scales.
You're saying that the 40,000 smaller employers would have to have increased rates.
There'd be a redistribution in the current allocation
to make up for the reduction of the 20,000
right.
on top.
Correct.
How much?
We don't know.
We haven't analyzed that. Excuse me, Senators. In the wee hours this morning, on a moment's notice, I put some extemporaneous thoughts together on paper.
Well, you don't have any parameters?
Well, the parameters on that would be that um, It's a tenancy, and that would have to be actuarially checked out to give you a more accurate picture.
I understand you can't give me an accurate picture. Give me the parameters.
But the parameters, nevertheless, that we have a higher rates of pay on an hourly basis. Oh, excuse me. Let me back up a moment so I can get your parameters. The higher rates of pay represent fewer hours worked for the same dollars of payroll, and thus the usage of the man hours as a premium basis would have a tendency to redistribute a greater portion of the manual premium to the smaller 440,000 lower paying employers. And since the total dollars of premium from all policyholders will not change, you have your classification group, they have a constant dollar amount, would not change. The only result of a premium basis change is to redistribute the premium dollars among employers.
I understand that.
Okay.
I want to know what the parameters are of the shift.
Well, that will vary, Senator, from classification to classification.
Well, if you don't know, that's fine. I understand it's very difficult to do. Just say you don't know, but is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. It's fine.
Mr. McGaddick, how hard would it be for you to determine the parameters for the committee?
That would be an actuarial question, Senator. You'd have to research. We could give you, I believe, ballpark figures.
We have an actuary in the department, Senator, and we could probably put him to work on it.
Not for every classification. Senator Smith he's looking at the, as you say, the ballpark figure. Could you get your actuary to come up with some cutoff point that we're talking about, of how much the lower percent are going to have to come up with the percentage, and the top will take a decrease?
Yeah, we can do that.
Okay, could you do it, please?
The other point is conversion costs. You have a 5-year transition period. Now, workers' comp is just another casualty line, and in casualty insurance, you use a 3-year period, experience period, and you must rely upon some statistical reporting system. And any such system is devisable is going to have a time lag. It is a time lag for the auditing, for the reporting of such statistical data, and this works out approximately to 4 years and 8 months. We'll round it and call it 5 years. Under such a system, typically this lag is going to pose some problems from the standpoint that you're confronted with a 5-year period where when you cured some of the difficulties in as much that it'd be uniform, you wouldn't have the dual system, but it would nevertheless require about approximately additional 30% staffing increase. Now, this is based on an observation of the Rating Bureau's difficulties in January 66 through 1969, where for 3 years they would move an employer along at no greater than 15% up or down variance in his premium from where he had been to where he should be going under the new program.
Mr. Senator Smith,
let me ask you a question at this point in a general framework of the discussion. Is it true that generally people are paid according to the hazard that they may face in their employment?
Yes, Senator.
And on all the rates of workman's compensation, and even in the private sector as well as SAFE, are based upon the question of how hazardous that particular classification is.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yes, Senator.
Yeah. That's a direct relationship between the losses incurred in any given class and the premium that is required to meet and pay those losses, plus the other.
Is it true that this bill, then, would allow or would provide for the less hazardous occupations the same rate as the more hazardous occupations?
Not necessarily so, Senator. The man-hour basis would substitute payroll as the exposure basis, and you have to develop a pure premium. Each one of the classifications utilized in the state has a pure premium the raw dollar cost of the losses to which are loaded your expenses.
I want the clerk to change the tape, but you go right ahead and keep talking. Go ahead and do it right now.
And